Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Charandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Renfield, which, as you may have guessed, follows Dracula's long-suffering, familiar victim, assistant, however you want to characterize him exactly. It's a horror comedy, perhaps most noteworthy for the fact that Nick Cage plays Dracula. That was certainly the big draw.
Yeah, and we in the audience are not long-suffering, if only because the movie clocks in at under 90 minutes.
Yeah, that's true. It is nice and brisk, so that at least is a point in its favor. I don't have a ton of strong feelings about this movie one way or another, really. I don't know how you felt about it.
Well, it's got that brisk runtime to its credit, but even with running all of 80-some minutes, it still feels like two movies in one. It's got a lot of cops and robbers drama grafted onto it that is fully half of the movie.
That's true.
It kind of speaks to the fact that the Dracula-Renfield relationship is just a one-joke premise that's better suited to a skit or a short film.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could have made a comedy that was just about the two of them in a more concerted way, but I think the fact that this movie is so cluttered up with other junk testifies to the fact that it is sort of a one-joke premise, and they couldn't squeeze any more blood from that stone after the first, 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And we'll get into that, obviously, more during the synopsis. But yeah, I did get that sense. That's true. There's a lot of other almost entirely unrelated business that they sort of glue together at the end.
Well, it really does feel that jarring. I mean, even the word glue is misleading because it feels like there's adhesive missing. I used the word grafted, which I guess has the same problem, but it's really bizarre. It is two movies in one. There's a supernatural as well as a non-supernatural protagonist, Renfield, and this cop character who he meets. And there's a supernatural as well as a non-supernatural antagonist. There's a mob boss in addition to Dracula. And bizarrely, I think that of the two protagonists, Renfield is the more important. And obviously, Dracula is a big deal in this movie. It's Nick Cage, but he kind of winds up being, if not subordinate to the who gives a shit mob boss character, then at least, we'll get into this in the plot rundown, but at the end of the movie, he shows up at her pad and is like, I have a proposal. And it's, I'm doing my Sebulba voice again from last episode.
He always wins.
It's like Hitler teaming up with Elmer Fudd. It's just like, well, I don't know. I don't think that they're operating at the same level.
It's just occurring to me now. I was wrong when I said it was a Sebulba voice. It's a Watto voice.
Well, okay,
that's what I meant.
Yeah,
because Sebulba doesn't speak English.
I haven't seen Phantom Menace in a hot minute, so I think that when you messaged me that, I think I just filled in the blanks. But you're right. It is ripped straight out of
the chance cube. Only money.
Yeah.
You won't win the direct. Okay, I'm gonna stop doing Watto now. But yeah, we might as well just get into the plot rundown here. How about you take it away?
First part of the movie is replete with narration, which then tapers off for a while and then comes back periodically, like a cold you can't quite shake. The opening scene, and you probably got this impression from the trailers, is in a support group. Victims of, I remember the tortured acronym. The tortured acronym is DRAG, DRAAG. I don't remember what it stands for, but I remember thinking that acronym's not funny enough to justify the tortured words that they cramped together to create it. There are people who have been victimized by abusive partners, narcissists, and what have you. And Renfield is just kind of a fly on the wall, ho-ho, in this setting. He doesn't have much to say for himself. He's just sort of eavesdropping on everyone else, talking about their partners, opening lines of the movie.
eavesdropping implies that he's like hiding in the shadows. He is sitting in the circle, but he's not sharing, I guess, is the... He's just a listener.
Might have been better if he'd been perched in the rafters like the Phantom of the Opera, but you're right, he is present. Opening line of the movie is a character whose name I don't remember and who doesn't really matter, talking about her significant other saying, he's a monster. And then we get quippy narration where Renfield's like, oh, lady, you don't know the half of it, basically. So we get a rundown of his history with Dracula, and this is almost certainly the highlight of the movie. There is a very faithful recreation of certain key moments from the Bela Lugosi Dracula, including, and this tickled me, that delightful...
shot down the stairs.
Yeah, the Dwight Fry laugh, if you can call it that.
Yeah, no, that's... right. No, that is the single best part of this movie. They're all like... basically, Nicholas Hoult, who plays Renfield, and then Nick Cage, Dracula, they're both sort of Forrest Gumped into all of the... I don't think it's a straight-up recreation. I think they're green-screened into actual footage from...
Yep, gotta be.
31 Dracula. But, you know, there's, welcome to my castle, and...
some of the footage, like...
I never drink wine.
Yeah,
and then,
right.
It even goes into the scene of Dracula going into the theater for the play or whatever. But yeah, the best one of these shots, and they're all, it's nice to see all of them, but the best one is definitely, yeah, that one that's like down the stairs into the hold of the ship where Renfield is just completely crazed.
Yeah, I mean, I think they did get gumped in there for sure. A lot of the exteriors that don't feature either Nick Cage or Nicholas Hoult are just... ripped, you know, like stuff of the castle or stuff of the Demeter is just ripped straight out of the original movie. Mm-hmm. I like actually that they didn't go to the trouble to try to recreate it, because seeing any amount of the Lugosi Dracula in this movie makes it the best part of this movie practically by default.
Right.
And Nick Cage, you know, when he's doing those famous lines, Children of the Night, I don't drink wine, and so on, he doesn't sound like Lugosi, but neither does he sound like Nicolas Cage. It's in some... middle ground. It's more effortful. I mean, you would never accuse Nicolas Cage of sleepwalking, you know, because he's always gonna show up and be accounted for. But there are times when he, I don't know, you couldn't really accuse him of phoning it in, but there are times when he is just so recognizably himself. I guess he just sort of doesn't try to fight his own screen presence and his own caginess. Here, it is a little more effortful than I was expecting. He is doing a voice, although it's not exactly a pitch-perfect Lugosi impression, although that's fine.
Yeah.
So we learn a whole lot about Renfield during this opening narration exposition dump. The thing that stood out and the thing that grated on me the most was the fact that he... so in the book and in all the movie adaptations... Renfield is just scarfing down bugs, whatever he can get his hand on. Any creepy crawly that scutters within arm's reach basically goes right down his gullet. And he does that because he's a madman who is crudely and pathetically trying to approximate Dracula's power. He's trying to do what Dracula does, but in this debased, sort of sad way. Here...
He eats
bugs, and it's like the sun for Superman. They're the source of his power, and that's just some flagrant cape shittery that really, really got on my nerves. And, you know, there's a funny bit midway through the movie, closer to the end, where he's about to have to fight a million dudes, and so he's desperately trying to find a bug, any bug.
Right, because he set his bugs free. He has a little box at the start, and he set them free when he's like, I'm getting out of this toxic relationship and all this stuff. But yeah, so he's scrambling for bugs, and it is worth a chuckle. But I agree with you that overall, it's a dumbass concept that, like you say, just completely dismisses what made Renfield's bug eating matter in the first place, is that it's an illustration of how debased he has become and how insane he is.
Well, and you could have kept that gag, which has a pretty good payoff that we'll get to in due time, and still stuck with a less MCU'd version of Renfield where he was just deluded and bugs. But even if the bugs had just been a placebo, I would argue that actually would be funnier.
Yeah.
If he was basically like John Wick, but he could only do it if he'd eaten a centipede first, you know, just for psychological reasons. Rather than him eating a dragonfly and then his eyes start glowing and it's just definitively, like, incontrovertibly something.
It's Morbin time or whatever.
Yeah, right. Precisely. I'm thinking of, like, Ben Stiller in Mystery Men. You know, how he thinks he's the Hulk and clearly isn't. He's just a normal guy. So the narration is really leaden a lot of the time. I mean, it would appear to be overflowing with personality and zaniness, but I found it aggravating. And part of that is just a matter of taste. Like, it was just a little smarmy for me, a little too Deadpool. But also, just mechanically, it doesn't always work. A key example being right here in this opening scene, Renfield alludes to the fact via narration, which is omnipresent at this point, that he comes to these meetings in order to scope things out and find victims, people to feed to Dracula, basically. And you're only allowed to believe for like a nanosecond that he's doing what you think he's doing. You think that it's this sinister arrangement where he picks off
members of the group.
Yeah, right. Whoever's the gazelle with the limp, you know, whoever's the most vulnerable member of the support group in any given week. But then he clarifies immediately via narration, like, no, don't worry,
he's doing a Dexter thing, like the Showtime show with Michael C. Hall. He's essentially like picking out bad people to murder, and the way the group factors in is he's picking the abusers, the people who abused the members of the group. That's who he's finding for food. And the only payoff of this, which is again a little bit funny, is when he brings some of these people to Dracula. Dracula chows down and then just starts spitting, like, these are disgusting. I need pure souls.
Right. It just drove me a little bit nuts because you're not allowed to think even for, and this twist, it's not like a third act reveal. It's just a little bit of sleight of hand. You're not even allowed to believe for a minute to 2-3 minutes that he's up to something nefarious. He has to immediately step in and say, oh no, don't you worry, I'm actually doing a Dexter. It's just, you're not allowed any moment of uncertainty for the twist, such as it is, to actually land. So he goes out to kill some druggies and gangsters in this warehouse full of cocaine. And they think at first that he's a hitman sent to kill them. And then that hitman actually does show up midway through the fracas. And the hitman is not like someone out of, say, a John Wick movie, but is instead like a slasher movie luchador for some reason. He's
a cross between like the killer from The Town That Dreaded Sundown and Pyramid Head. It's very weird.
It is very weird. It's like if you got a WWE wrestler at his most roided up to play Jason in Friday the 13th Part 2. I mean, it's just like this weird combination of He-Man, Muscle Mountain, and Backwoods Bumpkin that is totally incongruous in this like urban crime setting. I don't know.
Yeah, this isn't the Backwoods. They're in fucking New Orleans.
Yeah.
You know, they're not in the middle of goddamn. Maybe if they were like out in the bayou, it would make sense, but they're in the city. It's weird.
So this is when alarm bells started ringing for me. This is when we're introduced to the cop character whose name I don't have handy right this second.
Well, okay, so it's Awkwafina who plays the character. Rebecca Quincy, maybe? The only reason I remember, I'm pretty sure it's Rebecca, the only reason I remember the last name, Quincy, is because she has a dead cop father who we only see in the form of like a picture on the wall in the station. And his name is, or was, Morris Quincy, which, Quincy Morris, flipped him around. Yo.
It's like when those two peripheral characters showed up in The Invitation from, I don't know, 10 or so episodes ago, named Jonathan and Mina. You know, it's like what a 12-year-old writing Dracula fan fiction would think was clever.
Yeah, it's basically the same thing. So her whole thing, and this is, yeah, where the other movie comes in.
Mm-hmm.
She's got this vendetta against this local crime family, the Lobos.
And, you know, think like, okay, they don't seem to be like they're not like a cartel. They're not like a Mexican or Spanish crime outfit. They seem like a stock Italian movie gangster family, except that their surname is Lobos and their cocaine pricks are all branded with cartoon wolves with this like wolf logo, which seems bad for business, I would think, kind of incriminating when it's literally your legal name.
Well, and the matriarch of the family, I think the actress is like Iranian, and then her son is played by Ben Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
So even calling them Italian might be another case of my brain filling in the blanks.
Right. It's like, is he adopted? What's the... Whatever. So this crime family killed her dad because he was, you know, a stand-up cop in a corrupt town or whatever. And so she wants revenge. She's got an FBI agent sister who barely factors in except at the end as a plot device, kind of.
Quite literally shows up twice. First time is just to say, hey, he was my dad too. You know, scenes like that write themselves. Literally, I think that she says that or something very akin to that.
Just chat GPT.
Yeah, right. And then the second time she shows up, she's unconscious on a slab being held hostage during the climax.
There might be one other like 10-second appearance in the middle. But yeah, she's very peripheral. Anyway, Awkwafina wants to just dismantle this crime family, and she's kept on like DUI patrol duty and never has any traction, and yet she manages to catch Ben Schwartz committing crimes multiple times. He keeps getting away with it. It's a whole thing. But yeah, it's this fucking crime movie in the middle of your Dracula movie.
And a really shitty one, too. Like, really, by the numbers, doesn't even begin. It's like the kind of crime movie where you expect a golden retriever voiced by Dennis Leary to save the day or something. You know, it feels like it's made for children. It's, like, really insipid and simple-minded.
The Big Easy, it ain't. So the rest of the movie bounces back and forth between Renfield and his Dracula business, and then Awkwafina and her crime family business. And at one point, and this bit is in the trailer, Renfield rescues Awkwafina and some other like bar patrons from an attack by Ben Schwartz and his team of goons.
Yeah, Ben Schwartz is this incredibly obnoxious fail son who almost dies several times and never does until he finally does. But they save his comeuppance for the end of the movie for some reason. I thought for sure they were going to do like an enraged mama bear thing where he dies partway through and his Iranian crime boss mother was then going to go on the warpath. But no, he just keeps springing up and getting stronger and stronger, if anything. This first altercation in the bar, I thought he was going to meet his maker at the hands of Renfield, who scarfs down a fly like Popeye eating his spinach and then hands everybody their ass, saves Awkwafina's life. You saved my life. You're a hero. She lays it on real thick.
Mm-hmm.
Dracula isn't going to let that stand. He can feel psychically, it seems, Dracula slipping away from his talons. And so he reels him back in. And Dracula's first few appearances are sort of funny, just because A, it's Nicolas Cage, and B, he's doing a reverse American Werewolf in London, where, like Griffin Dunn, except here he is reconstituting himself steadily. There was a bit in the prologue where he was incinerated by sunlight, and so every time we see him, he's slightly more put together than he was the previous time, but still pretty grisly. It's actually sort of disappointing once he's got all his skin back on, because then it's just Nicolas Cage in a Dracula cape, which is fine, but not as much fun as when he's falling to pieces like fucking Christopher Lloyd and Anastasia. I think should have done more with it, if anything. Losing an ear, losing, you know, an eye rolls out, what have you.
Right.
I don't know if you have any frame of reference for this. I imagine you would, because it's a fairly viral internet clip from back in the day. One of his appearances, I believe it's this one, after the bar throwdown, he looks exactly like old Greg. Does that mean anything to you?
I don't think I ever watched the old Greg video. I've heard people say old Greg. That's about the extent of my connection.
It's inescapable. Okay, well, take my word for it. I never watched any Mighty Boosh outside of an old Greg here or there. In any case, Nick Cage is having some fun with it. And despite trying to lure Renfield back in, Renfield chops off his The Cure hair and starts trying to be a normal guy. And this was the only big laugh in the movie for me. He goes to the police station with a bouquet of flowers for Awkwafina. And one of the cops is like, do you always bring flowers when you're turning state's evidence or whatever? and Renfield says, they're for everyone. And then he starts handing them out.
But the problem is he hands one to the cop next to him. And then he just gives the rest to Awkwafina. He should have committed to the bit.
Yes, it would have been much funnier if they
should
have
just spent 90 straight seconds just and one for you. And one for you.
Tucked it into someone's lapel.
missed opportunity.
He goes back to his apartment. This was also sort of a clever riff on vampire lore. Dracula has gained entry to his apartment because there's a welcome mat out front, and the camera, I don't like the swishy, hyperactive, Deadpool-y sort of camera work for the most part in this movie. Fight choreography didn't do much for me. However, the way the camera tilts down to the welcome mat here and then tilts back up to Renfield's face as he registers his mistake was pretty funny. A lot of it is very sub-Edgar Wright. That felt like a visual gag that Edgar Wright would have actually done and done it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked that too.
So, in the apartment, Dracula is fully himself again, for better or for worse, and Renfield is trying to use support group terminology on him, and it's not working, obviously, and so Dracula vows to wage unceasing war upon his former servant, basically. And I think at this point he's taken Ben Schwartz under his wing, and he's going to be the replacement Renfield.
Yeah, because Ben Schwartz was trying to track down Renfield, because Renfield like fucked up a bunch of his guys and whatnot and kept trying to turn state's evidence. So he tracks him to the abandoned hospital where Renfield for a while before he moved out, and then Dracula is still there, but they were both kind of hunkered down in there. And so Ben Schwartz, all of his guys get killed and drained by Dracula. And then basically Ben Schwartz makes a I'll be your slave pitch, more or less. Although in his mind, he's framed it as some kind of partnership.
Yeah, it's the second instance of this happening where Ben Schwartz, the world's luckiest fail son, should have died and could have died, but doesn't. He goes into the heart of Dracula's lair. All of his goons get eviscerated, and then he lives to fight another day, and in fact get sick bug chomping Renfield powers the next time we see him.
Yep.
And it's weird because you know they're setting him up as a foil for Renfield. And the only reason to keep Ben Schwartz alive and to give him superpowers is so that the two of them can have a showdown. But then the movie also doesn't take that idea seriously correctly. There's a bit during their final duel when Ben Schwartz is talking about how he's the yang to Renfield's whatever. and Renfield is like, we've met twice, and you know he doesn't they're not arch nemeses. And that's kind of funny, but on the other hand, if they're not arch nemeses, then why are we doing this? You know, it's like pointing out the stupidity of it only gets you so far.
So I guess we might as well move into the end game. There's a few throwaway scenes here or there throughout.
Yeah, our enthusiasm is already waning for obvious reasons. Dracula goes to the support group, kills everybody. This is him making good on his promise to make Renfield's life a living hell. Renfield is clapped in irons by Awkwafina, who shows up at the site of this massacre and finds Renfield covered in blood. And as he's being led outside in handcuffs, Awkwafina's partner betrays her. She's like, did you call in backup? And he's kind of ominously like, yeah. And then a moment later, a bunch of crooked cops show up with Mama Lobo in tow. Or if she's not physically present, they're at least, she's there. Okay. And it's like when a character betrays you in a video game and you're not invested in the plot. Like, maybe you've even been skipping some of the cutscenes. You know, it's like when Barry turns on you in Resident Evil and you're like, oh, that's fine. Like, it's like
Master of Unlocking.
Yeah, the most meaningless Judas moment in the history of movies. And Renfield and Awkwafina escape, and then there's the kind of funny gag where he needs to eat a bug the following day because a bunch of evil SWAT dudes are bearing down on them, and he winds up breaking open a kid's, what do they call them, like an ant colony?
Ant farm.
Ant farm, and just guzzling sand. Which is a funny image, but I argue would be funnier if he were out of his mind and just believed he had to eat bugs, despite all evidence to the contrary, in order to be a destroyer of men. He does proceed to destroy a whole bunch of men in sort of goopy creative ways, but really the only kill in this whole movie that I liked is right at the very beginning, and it's not Renfield who does it, it's Dracula. He turns into a mist, flies into a priest's mouth, and then explodes him from the inside.
Yeah.
And that's cool, but then it's ruined mere seconds later by Renfield via narration going like, whoa, didn't see that coming. It's like, oh, God damn.
What's up, guys? It's your boy. You know, it's that level of commentary.
Yeah,
It's shitty YouTuber commentary.
Yeah, spare me the freeze frames and the play-by-play. So now the stage is set for the climax. Basically, Awkwafina gets a phone call. Her sister, who we've met one and a half times at most.
We've met twice.
Exactly. It's just as facile as the Ben Schwartz antagonism thing, but the movie doesn't appear to realize that it's equally as disposable. You know, because when in doubt, screenwriters can just fall back on these platitudes. You know, we're sisters. We lost our dad, you know, and that's supposed to furnish the movie with something. But if anything, it detracts from the movie because, like you said, it sounds like it was written by an AI program. So they go to rescue the sister. They suit up first, more kind of wannabe Edgar Wright flourishes, more like Edgar Wrong, haha, as they're, you know, getting stakes and bugs and whatever else. So they show up at not Dracula's lair, but the lair of Mama Lobo, who Dracula has proposed an alliance with. Ben Schwartz is there, and he's got a bunch of superpowered hombres, and they all fight Renfield, and Renfield beats all of them. He saves Ben Schwartz for last, who mercifully does finally die here after some banter, and this is intercut with Dracula proposing a Faustian bargain to, because his blood has healing properties. This was established near the beginning of the movie when he heals Renfield after he fights the Jason Voorhees luchador man. And, which is a thing that never recurs, by the way. I thought that scene was setting up a really bizarre criminal universe of wacky larger than life characters, but it's just the one hitman.
Just the guy, the one guy.
We don't even know who he's working for. Probably the Lobos, because they're seemingly the only game in town, because this movie was written by and for children.
Well, no, he definitely works for the Lobos. This guy almost, I think he's almost the way he is because they wanted to shoehorn in this one dumb joke, which I'm going to recount now. During the scene where this guy shows up and fights Renfield, it cuts to Ben Schwartz in his car outside, and he's on the phone with somebody. He's like, yeah, Apache Joe's in there taking care of it. I don't know, he's 6'6" and tears people's heads off while they're still alive. You try telling him his name's racist. That's the punchline. I don't remember word for word what the lead in is, but that's, yeah. It's like, okay, good for you. I don't even see how Apache Joe fits that costume design, but whatever.
I don't think it does. And then every other goon that we meet is just standard issue for the rest of the movie. Very bizarre. Yeah. Renfield wipes out a whole bunch of those goons. Now their eyes are glowing and they're doing underworld kung fu. But he still wipes the floor with them because I guess he just eats bugs better than they do. Or he's been at it a lot longer than they have. You know, it's not his first rodeo.
Yeah.
He then winds up fighting Dracula. Awkwafina appeared to be getting suckered in by his Faustian gambit, but it was just a ruse. She raises these like storm curtains or steel shutters so that sunlight floods in and doesn't kill him. He turns into a bunch of bats and flies away, then somehow cuts the power, and then they wind up duking it out in the dark. And the long and the short of it is that Renfield says some self-help pablum to him while they're fighting, and then Awkwafina sees a big pile of branded cocaine bricks. With the
circle of salt? That's for plebs. I'm gonna make a circle of coke.
Yeah, she makes a circle of cocaine, which binds Dracula, and Awkwafina says something about how she found out about it from Wiccan Tumblr. She just recites. I don't think we even hear her reciting anything.
We don't.
She says, yeah, any powder works as long as you know the right magic words. This comes out of fucking nowhere. And I don't care for lore reasons. It's just, it would have been theoretically a funny capper if she had any propensity towards internet goth behavior, or like right. if there was a scene with her and her sister where the sister was making fun of an old picture of her, like, look at your hair, that was when you were going through your Wiccan phrase,
then yeah, and that would have established a semblance of a real relationship between these two sisters.
Yeah, I can do this shit in my sleep. It's amateur hour. Anyway, really, really disappointing ending. And then they wail on the count until he's reduced to goo, and then they put his ashes in cement, and then put the cement in an ice cube tray, and then they put the cement cubes. You would think that they would put it somewhere for safekeeping under lock and key. Instead, they just kind of dump it down a manhole, I think, which seems like a surefire way to usher him back into the world of the living sooner rather than later. I don't think it's a sequel hook. In any case, this movie will not be getting a sequel regardless, so it doesn't matter. But whatever. I guess the movie is over at this point. I assume there was an epilogue. No, there is an epilogue. He's back at the support group, and they're all alive, having been restored to life by Dracula's blood. That was the nature of the Faustian thing. He was going to use his blood to heal the fed sister of Awkwafina because she had been beaten to a pulp by the Lobos. This business with Dracula's blood having healing properties, I was fine with it when he was healing Renfield, his servant, less so when he's offering it just to anybody and everybody to have a bargaining chip. I don't think that Dracula would be that forthcoming with his blood, and the implication is that you can use it without incurring any consequences other than the term of the deal that he's offering you. You know, like he's Ursula the Sea Witch or something. You know? It plays much more like that. You would think that being healed by the blood of Dracula would make you a Renfield, basically. I mean, that's always half of it. You know, you have
Historically, in Dracula fiction or various media, if you consume Dracula's blood, you're bound to him. And oftentimes you just become a vampire. It's some combination of him biting you and him giving you the blood.
Right. No, him offering you a vein, you know, on his wrist or wherever is actually historically more important. You drinking his blood is more important than him drinking your blood. That's just kind of foreplay. When you drink his blood, that's when he actually gets your signature on the dotted line.
Yeah.
Because there's something more, yeah, I don't know if consensual is the right word, but you're enthralled to him at that point. You're under his thumb. And the movie does not pitch it that way at all. This, I guess, could be lampshaded with the whole sister deal because maybe he's just not being forthcoming about the possible consequences. But when the whole fucking support group, and there's like a dozen or more of them, come back to life, they're no worse for the wear.
Nope.
There's one line about how one of them, having seen the afterlife, is going to be shell-shocked forever, which is sort of funny. I think it's funny on paper, but the movie had expended my reserves of goodwill at that point. It burned yeah. them down into ashes and then put those ashes into cement and then put that cement in an ice tray.
And down the manhole.
Yeah, right into a fucking sewer. And that's it. Roll credits. Mercifully short, less than 90 minutes.
More after the break.
Sorry to interrupt.
Are you okay?
I need to get out of a toxic relationship.
Why don't you start by telling us what brought you here?
My boss, he's different.
You can't get him out of your head.
No.
I need your assistance.
I'm coming, Master!
Oh, you feel like he could destroy you with the snap of his fingers?
Wouldn't even need to snap.
Okay.
Uh-huh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, what?
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Hi, are you here for the meeting? Well, come on!
No! No!
Some call me the Dark One. Others, the Lord of Death. To most, I am Dracula.
Okay, obviously we're dealing with a little bit more than just narcissism here.
Now, let's eat.
And we're back. Like I said up top, I don't have particularly strong feelings about this movie, so I'm not going to have a ton to say about it. It does have this weird... Inside this movie, there are two bears.
Yes.
And both bears are malnourished and arthritic. And just generally unimposing.
Well, the way I would run this metaphor into the ground is there are two bears, both of whom are underfed. However, one of the bears has an incurable disease. It is not long for this world, and like no amount of food is going to save it, but it keeps stealing the other bear's food just to, you know, pointlessly prolonging a life that, or attempting to prolong a life that cannot be prolonged. And so the bear that has a chance is going hungry while its greedy brother scarfs up, you know, a double portion that is just wasted on its emaciated, diseased frame. The dying bear, of course, is the cop procedural, and the bear that had a chance, obviously, is the Renfield Dracula stuff in
which
this
is
Renfield
what you would
movie.
Expect the movie to be about.
Yes. It's the half with Nick Cage in it.
What's the half with Nick Cage in it? And I think there's a very obvious reason that none of the cop procedural stuff... I mean, Awkwafina is in the trailer. but the cop procedural stuff in general does not make any kind of appearance in the trailer, because who gives a fuck?
Mm-hmm.
I spent most of those scenes, those cop scenes, just be like, why is this here? We've just got this running gag where there's this cop named Kyle who everybody says, shut the fuck up, Kyle, to. That's not funny.
No.
That wasn't funny 25 years ago.
It's like they had a spec script for like Brooklyn Nine-Nine that wasn't picked up because it didn't cut the mustard. And then they just sort of reverse engineered it into this other half-baked idea. You know, they had like a 40-page script for a Dracula Renfield feature. And then they just stitched them together like old-timey charlatans telling you they've got a mermaid corpse when they've just combined half a dead monkey with half a dead fish. It's
yeah.
really hideous.
Yeah, it's very weird. There's, again, I would have stronger negative feelings about this movie if it were a complete wash, if there were nothing in it to recommend it. And that's not the case. There are a few things in this movie that are worthwhile. We talked about a few of them in the plot rundown. The stuff on the front end, Forrest Gumping their way through Dracula 31. That's mm-hmm. all good. Obviously, they weren't going to be able to make the whole movie out of that. There's just no way. And Nick Cage as Dracula in general is fun. There's some vampire's kiss energy in there from time to time. There's also one, and I mean, it crops up multiple times because it's in Dracula's abandoned hospital lair. But he's got like a, it's almost like a tree of drained blood bags hanging behind his throne, such as it is, in this big open space in the abandoned hospital. And that's kind of striking to look at. But yeah, it's surrounded by all this pablum, you know, this shitty cop procedural and this Good Morning Gamers narration.
It is really like record scratch cinema. Like, you're probably wondering how I got myself into this situation. You know, that's become such a meme at this point. I think the last good movie to do something like that was probably Ratatouille. You know, you gotta put that shit to bed. Or,
I mean,
if
we're not counting Scorsese doing it in Wolf of Wall Street because it wasn't the first time.
Sure, yeah.
That's somewhat more recently. But even that was 10 fucking years ago.
Mm-hmm. That's true. There were occasionally, like, did you see that moments in Wolf of Wall Street? Like, when they're rescued from the shipwreck and the helicopter goes down, I remember. But the movie doesn't freeze frame. It's just narration, obviously, at least going back to Goodfellas, is a Scorsese staple, so maybe we give him more leeway.
He's also
in the hands of a master in those movies.
Yeah, he also knows how to do it. I think when they're tossing the little people as a game, I think there's frames in there. That's what was
right,
coming to mind. But anyway, yeah, it's number one. It's Martin Scorsese. He can fucking get away with it because mm-hmm. he's Martin Scorsese. And also, he knows how to do it effectively. But again, even that was 10 years ago. That was all pre-Deadpool and, I don't know, other movies of its ilk. None of them are jumping to mind right now. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's so tired.
Yeah, it's all very Max Landis-y, for lack of a better term.
Ugh.
And I don't even, the stuff, if I were the kind of person who got really bent out of shape about the lore, this movie would vex me to no end. I mean, I am annoyed by a lot of the lore stuff in this movie, like Bugs being his Popeye spinach and Dracula's blood being this consequence-free panacea. But really, as ever, it always comes down to the execution. And I wouldn't mind any of that so much if it were just put to good use. Even Renfield having superpowers, which is a total bastardization of who his character is supposed to be. That's the kind of dumb bastardization that I could get on board with in the right context. It's like what they would have done if Renfield had joined the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And I'm talking about the movie.
Right.
Well, you know, and in that context, I think it would have been dumb fun because there would have been 5 to 10 other stupid bastardizations running around, distracting you from the fact that Renfield's eyes glow every time he eats an earwick. You know, like, then it would have been like, yeah, they're all here, and you know, it's a team effort in a sense, and it's harmonious. It's holistically stupid in a cohesive kind of way. Here, it's just like, it just feels like they got it wrong. And then it clashes terribly with the parts of the Dracula legend that are played straight, and with the cop procedural stuff, which just has no business being here at all. So there's nothing homogenous or cohesive about it.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of the cop procedural stuff, which we just can't get away from, it's kind of the black hole at the center of all this, the movie, and to be fair, it would have this problem even if you took half of the movie out, the monkey half, as opposed to the mermaid, as opposed to the fish half, let's say. If you took out all the Awkwafina crap, you would still have this problem, but it would be less prominent and maybe more warranted. But the problem is that it is painfully earnest at times. You know, at first it seems like a joke that Renfield is going to therapy and trying to use these self-help terms to defeat Dracula because it's such an inept gesture. You know, it's like, break out the fucking holy wafers and the garlic. What are you doing? But ultimately, the movie's heart is in all of that, and the stuff with Awkwafina and her sister is likewise sort of another case where the movie is wearing its heart on its sleeve. And it just creates this tonal thing. And I debated whether I was going to get into this. The first time it happened, or the first time I was struck by it, was in the bar. Ben Schwartz has Awkwafina at gunpoint, and he's really chewing her out and twisting the knife in her verbally and saying, you know, like, we tortured your dad real good. Oh, we made him squeal like a pig. He was a coward. You know, he gave up everybody. And it goes on and on and on. And Ben Schwartz, at least on the basis of this performance, does not have those kind of villainy chops, so he just can't really sell it. And the character as written is kind of a fail son anyway, so I don't know why they would assign that monologue to him in that moment. It just feels like the writer's instinct at various junctures is to veer into this kind of maudlin drama where you're meant to actually take all of this seriously. And on the basis of that first scene, it reminded me of something very specific. And I thought, like, all right, that was just a one-off. It was not a one-off. It happens over and over again. It happens repeatedly in the Dracula-Renfield scenes, where Dracula is, again, twisting the knife like Ben Schwartz and being really cruel and reducing Renfield to just, like, a flood of tears and really just kind of ripping him to pieces emotionally. Happens during the climax. The sister stuff, I think, is supposed to be emotional, which is impossible for me to imagine. but I believe that was the intent. And it reminded me of a formative experience of mine, kind of a scarring experience of mine. When I was in seventh grade, I wrote a play for a school project. And as was the norm for me back then, I overshot the parameters of the assignment, and my little one act had to be performed over the course of two class periods in our drama class. And teachers in middle school would give me that kind of latitude because I was perceived as being bright or talented, and that had gone to my head. And this was the first time that I really had an ignominious failure, the first time I can remember anyway, feeling like I fucked up. The first half killed, was like really funny. Whole drama class was digging it. Second day, and it's not like I wrote it in two installments. I wrote it all in one lump thing. And just the way it broke down from one day to the next, the second day was just a dirge. You know, like, it was like, because I started taking, and I barely even remember what I wrote. It's not worth getting into the details anyway, what little I do remember. But the second half, I just started taking it way too seriously. You know, there were villain monologues in it, or a villain monologue that went on way too long. I remember that particularly. And then there were some jokes at the end, but by that point it was just a disaster, and I couldn't save it. And I wasn't even reading any of it. I assigned roles to different actors. It was just like a stage reading. Everyone was sitting down. It wasn't like a production or anything. It wasn't like something I slaved over for weeks. It was just something I kind of dashed off, but it was still humiliating because I realized in the moment that I had flown too close to the sun and really misjudged my audience and myself and just what the situation called for. And there was a substitute teacher that second day, not our usual drama teacher, who was present for the reading of the first half. And I asked the sub if we could skip over some of the long-winded, serious parts, because I realized they weren't landing. And for whatever reason, she said no, and she will be answerable for that at the at the pearly gates. Because I don't know why she did that to me. But we had to read every godforsaken word. And afterwards, there was a girl in the class that I had just an all-consuming crush on. And she didn't read for it. She wasn't any of the characters. But afterwards, I remember we were like walking down the hall together, and I don't remember what I said. I alluded to the fact that it had been
a bomb,
a catastrophe. And she said, yeah, well, it gave me a chance to catch up on some of my homework. she'd been doing her homework while I bombed. And that was gutting. And I've yet to recover from it. And Renfield reminded me of, it's such a specific feeling when something you're watching goes off the rails in that particular way. And Renfield gave me that feeling over and over and over again, maybe more than any other movie I've ever seen. It happened chronically. And I think you know what I'm describing, where it just gets high on its own supply and forgets the funny and starts to, and it's not to say that movies can't do both, but when you're basically a true blue comedy and then you start doing drama ineptly, and especially seeding too much, you know, especially if you're like trying to make your villains scary and you just don't have it.
It's the classic example of the horror comedy, quote unquote, that fails to be either funny or scary. And in this particular case, it also tries to shoehorn in a third genre, if you could call drama a genre as such, but it tries to shoehorn in drama, like a crime drama, too. And like you say, it's inept. It's not woeful. Good.
Yeah.
So it fails on three fronts, which is hard to do.
And in a way, it's good to have that kind of experience when you're in seventh grade, because it's the sort of thing that's, you just think, never again. Not to say that I've had impeccable instincts ever since, but I've been at least leery of making that same mistake twice, because I don't care to stare into that particular abyss ever again. So when I said during the plot rundown at one point, I believe I said that this movie was written by and for children, I knew what I was talking about. It had that same flavor for me, that eerily reminiscent of that traumatic episode in my youth. There's just a lot of stuff in it that made me think, like, this should have stayed between you and your therapist. You know, like at the end, the happy ending, which of course Renfield is narrating all over, he says something like, and he says as much during his final showdown with Dracula, too. He says, I am a codependent. What does he say? Maybe he does say that.
Yeah, codependent is the word that keeps cropping up.
Yeah. I am a codependent, but I am no longer a victim. And it's just like, with this, I appreciate what you're going for here. You have to own, you know, it's the same as like if you're an alcoholic or whatever else, you have to own the nature of the affliction and say it without shame. But it just doesn't make for a rousing speech. You know, it's not like, I am a codependent. It's like, all right, it doesn't feel like a victory lap. And maybe it would have if they had contextualized that word differently or front-loaded it. But it really only comes up with any prominence near the end of the movie. And then he's touting it as though it's some kind of character breakthrough that he's had. And it just does feel like something of the writer has slipped through in kind of an embarrassing way. That might be projection, but I don't know how else to account for it. It made me feel like I was privy to something that I should not have been. And obviously, I'm a chronic oversharer. I just rambled about seventh grade for what felt like 20 minutes. But
yeah,
you know.
Get a hold of yourself, Matt. This is a movie that I have become progressively more down on as we talk about it, which is... It happens to me from time to time. Sometimes I come in with a head full of steam, and I hate a movie from second one. And sometimes I get to the end of a movie and realize, yeah, no, that was bad. Not even the end of the movie, but the end of the podcast, you know. So that's kind of where I'm at now.
When this movie was first announced, everyone was going apeshit, losing their minds, because, oh my god, Nicolas Cage is going to play Dracula. That's awesome. And my reaction, sourpuss that I am, was to go, you know, that's fine. I would rather see a movie where Nick Cage plays Renfield. You know,
sure.
I want Absolutely. A movie that's just Nick Cage in a Victorian asylum screaming about blood for 90 minutes. And then Dracula shows up at the end and he's played by Mads Mikkelsen or something. You know,
yeah.
I think Nicolas Hell Cage yeah. is the wild man.
And that's what Renfield is supposed to be.
Right. Not this, you know, put upon sidekick, although I understand that's a workable shtick for a movie like this if you're trying to make it about power dynamics and narcissistic relationship abuse.
Codependency, yeah.
But I wanted Nick Cage to play Renfield instead, and I have to push back against something you said earlier, although you only said it in passing. Nick Cage in Vampire's Kiss, which I consider an underrated movie, is one of the great movie Renfields, although he's not called that. But basically, that's the nature of his disorder. He's a guy who thinks he's a vampire, or he's an aspiring vampire, which is what Renfield is.
Right.
But he's basically terrestrial and just off his rocker. And that's what I look for in the Renfield character. I think that's what makes Vampire's Kiss so funny. I was prepared to hate that movie based on its reputation. You and I watched it together. I don't even know how long ago. I had only been exposed to it through YouTube compilations of Nick Cage acting a fool, you know.
I'm a vampire.
A,
yes.
B, C, D. Yeah. and it's surprisingly good, I thought, going in with measured expectations. Kind of a proto-American psycho satire of yuppie parasites.
Right.
And a guy losing his grip on reality, you know, a suit.
Right. So I get where the pushing back is coming from theoretically. I guess when I said that Nick Cage is bringing some of the Vampire's Kiss energy, I didn't mean necessarily that his Dracula was characterized in the same way as his whatever the hell his character's name is in Vampire's Kiss.
No.
It's more just some of the line reads and some of the expressions, like the mad gleam in his eye. It felt similar to that, even though overall, yeah, he's not doing a Renfield as Dracula here, because that would be inexplicable and stupid.
Well, that's true.
And Vampire's Kiss, you're right. He is very much a Renfield, a would-be Renfield.
Yeah. No, he does lapse into it on occasion when he's lecturing Renfield, and it doesn't happen very often, because usually he's being cutting. Or sadistic.
Mostly it happens in the scene where Dracula has used the welcome mat to enter his apartment and is there waiting for him, and then just sort of tears into him.
Yeah, it happens whenever he's lecturing Renfield in like a paternalistic kind of faux affectionate way, because he spends Nicolas Cage spends most of Vampire's Kiss like hectoring his subordinates, yelling at secretaries and his presumed inferiors. That's why he screams the alphabet at that poor woman. It's something to do with the filing, if memory serves.
Right.
You know, so no, you're right. He does dip into it every now and again. It's definitely not the same voice that he used in Vampire's Kiss. For more of that voice, you will have to go to Color Out of Space when he starts
it
doing
just
it.
Just goes away. Yeah, I forgot about that. He does do that voice in Color Out of Space. Oh shit.
He has his canines get long when he's about to drink blood or end lives, but most of the time he has uniformly sized piranha teeth, you know, where they've all just kind of been filed to points. And I don't like the look of that, especially because the movie opens with such a one-to-one Lugosi pastiche. You expect a more conventional Lugosi vampire mouth situation.
Yes.
But it's justified in the long run, because when he shows up at the church or the gymnasium or whatever it is to lay waste to the support group, he has a top hat and cane. And with the top hat and the teeth, he looks just like Lon Chaney in London After Midnight, which is a lost film. And so I guess in the spirit of keeping lost films alive and circulating in the public consciousness, that's a noble effort. I wasn't expecting that. I don't know if it was an intentional homage. I feel like it has to be because it's so on the nose. But I was here for that, and I didn't think I was going to be. I was ready to just write that off as another mistake, and then it kind of won me back.
Yeah.
So do watch Vampire's Kiss, and do watch Martin, the George Romero film, which I'm not going to formally recommend again because I just did it when we reviewed Bones and All, I think.
I think so,
but
yeah.
Do watch, I don't know, The Departed. Speaking of Martin Scorsese or virtually any other cops and gangsters movie, even middling ones.
Watch Copland, man.
Yeah, Copland. Watch State of Grace. You know, basically anything from the 90s, any like 6 or 7 out of 10 is just going to blow the socks off you. Relative
watch
to
The
this
Big
movie.
Easy.
Yeah, Big Easy's great. I like Big Easy a lot. And
cop movie in The Big Easy.
Do play Resident Evil. And I wish I could recommend London After Midnight, but it is a lost film. TCM, Turner Classic Movies, reconstituted it as best they could a while back, like 20 or so years ago. And it's mostly made up of still frames and silent movie intertitles. But it's better than nothing, I guess. Gives you a very rough idea of how the movie might have played. My formal recommendation is going to be Dracula Dead and Loving It, the Mel Brooks movie, for one reason and one reason only. It's not a very good movie. However, Peter McNichol's Renfield is a pitch perfect Dwight Fry. He's like, it's inspired. He's easily the best part of the movie. And there's a scene where he's having lunch with, I think, Dr. Seward would stand to reason, as he runs the loony bin, and he is behind Seward's back grabbing flies out of the air and like sneaking bites of them, but trying to act reformed and sane. And every time he shows up, the movie just starts firing on all cylinders. It's a very funny performance, and it really is like a carbon copy of Dwight Fry, which is just something that this movie is not going for. It's not going for it in the case of Lugosi, and it's not going for it in the case of Fry either, despite initial appearances that might be the case, where they do try to seamlessly blend the two.
Yeah,
and I don't care that they weren't trying to do a perfect like chameleonic impression, but if you want that, then Dracula Dead and Loving It is the movie for you, because boy howdy, it's a way better performance than that movie deserves.
Yeah, given Peter McNichol's performance in Ghostbusters 2, it makes perfect sense to me that he could do a note perfect Dwight Fry Renfield.
Right.
A lot of the same energy there.
Mm-hmm. The put upon assistant.
Right. So film I'm going to recommend, I may have recommended this before in some vampire context or horror comedy context, but if I have, fuck it, I'm doing it again. The film is called Love at First Bite. It's not really a horror movie at all. It is a vampire movie, but it's pretty much a straight-up comedy. It stars George Hamilton as Dracula, which is already funny.
I've never seen that one. It's on my to-do list.
Yeah, I saw it at the NuBev in LA. It was part of a horror comedy all-night marathon. It was like, I think it was the first movie, so it was the one I actually remember the best.
Was that the one where your spirit was absolutely demolished by that Chevy Chase movie?
Oh, my God. Well, not as much as my buddy Michael, who I think legitimately finds Modern Problems to be the worst film he's ever seen. He just viscerally hates it.
I've seen neither. I couldn't remember if it was Modern Problems or Memoirs of an Invisible Man, but I knew that one or the other had really put a damper on that whole evening. I remember you talking about that.
Well, yeah, because it was Love at First Bite, which is pretty good, and I'll get back to that in a second. And then it was American Werewolf in London, which is great, obviously. And then it was Beetlejuice, which is also very good. And then it's like approaching 2 a.m.,
and were both already rather tired. I had trouble even getting through Beetlejuice, and here comes Modern Problems, which is just this fucking death march through. It's the most unlikable Chevy Chase performance I've ever seen, and I'm including his character from Community, who is like actively a bad guy. And so by the time Fearless Vampire Killers rolled around as the last film, I was basically entirely checked out, which is kind of a shame. I probably need to watch that movie again.
Well, it just sounds like the kind of, it's like when it's last call at the bar and they put on a song that's supposed to clear the room. You know, it's like they wanted to get a head start on sweeping up the joint or something.
Well, they gave away these free hats to everybody who stuck it all the way out. Maybe they didn't want to give away too many hats. I don't know.
Maybe.
But anyway, so Love at First Bite, George Hamilton's Count Dracula travels to New York to find a bride. He's got Renfield along with him, and he deals with all these problems living in New York. And he finds this woman that he wants to make his bride, but she has a boyfriend who's this psychiatrist who just makes it his mission to foil Dracula as much as he can. And it's funny. I came into that movie knowing almost nothing about it and having zero expectations. The big draw was back-to-back American Werewolf in London and Beetlejuice, and then also Fearless Vampire Killers, if I thought I could make it. And I was very pleasantly surprised at the end of Love at First Bite. So that is my formal recommendation for this film. It's much, much better than Renfield. And I also obviously second all your recommendations, Vampire's Kiss in particular. It's very fitting, obviously. Well, now that Renfield has acknowledged his codependency, we can be rid of this film forever, I think. But until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Jarendaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Renfield official trailer, uploaded by Universal Pictures Entertainment. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, May 14th, and we will be discussing the latest installment in the Evil Dead franchise, Evil Dead Rise. See you then.